On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
You have this kind of asymmetrical warfare coming from a guy who's great at a soundbite, lousy at an answer.
So are you looking for your own billionaire?
Nope. No, I don't want my own billionaire. I'm going to raise the vast majority of the money.
Brace yourself, America, for what?
King Trump.
I'm Warren Olney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
Now America is once again at a moment of reckoning. Powerful forces are threatening to pull us apart. Bonds of trust and respect are fraying. And just as with our founders, there are no guarantees. It truly is up to us. We have to decide whether we will all work together so we can all rise together.
Hillary Clinton calling for unity in her speech last night at the DNC. Well, now the conventions are over. The general election campaign begins in earnest. 3 more months of starkly different visions for the country. We are a polarized country. Polarized. And that is the title of a new book by James Campbell, a political science professor at the University of Buffalo. He's been studying why the nation seems so divided right now.
We've been polarized more severely than at present. But I think the reason that polarization looks so extreme is that we went through a period in the middle of the 20th century where we weren't heavily polarized. The parties were politically heterogeneous. You had plenty of conservative Democrats and liberal Republicans. The generations that dominated the population at that time had gone through the Depression and World War II together, and that galvanized them. The differences among them didn't seem so stark. They could deal with each other much more effectively. Beginning in the late 60s, though, that changed.
What was it that caused it? Was it the Vietnam War primarily?
I think the Vietnam War, the Civil Rights Movement, and demographics play a big role in this, too. Simply the baby boomers hadn't gone through that unifying experience that their parents and grandparents had gone through. They were fine with arguing and protesting one side or the other. And if you go back to those days, you had the hard hats and the hippies, and if you weren't one or the other, chances are you had more sympathies for one side or the other. The parties, however, lagged behind. So one of the points the major points of my study is that polarization is really a democratic process. It's really the result of the system representing the differences among Americans much more faithfully than it had.
So you're saying it's actually a good thing because it reveals that we live in a healthy democracy?
Well, it's a good thing in the sense that the system is responding to the real differences that are out there. They aren't ignoring those or muting those differences. They're representing them.
Now, you say that politicians lag behind the sentiments of the public when it comes to polarization. What is behind the public's increasing polarization? Is it that we went through a period where people moved out of cities and into their own separate suburban enclaves? Is that part of it?
Well, I think the bottom line of this is that it involves basic differences about how people see government. Some people have good experiences with government and think government can provide answers to a lot of public problems and foster social justice and so forth. And others see the government as more of an impediment than more of a threat. And if you go back to the Federalist Papers, you see this this concern. You know, government should be used for public purposes, but on the other hand, you have to keep an eye on it. You have to be ever vigilant so that it doesn't actually infringe on your rights and liberties. So, and I think so. What we're seeing now is that same kind of conflict, and people choosing up sides as to whether they think government is more of a friend or more of an enemy.
Well, what about when it comes to feeling a part of this melting pot that we like to think America is? And does that play into this idea of polarization along political lines, that we are maybe not such a melting pot as we like to think of, and that our demographics and the way that we organize our lives, our non-political lives, play a big role in how we express ourselves politically?
Right. I think diversity in the demographics and in the social and religious and in all respects of our lives affects how we see politics and how we see the role of government. What makes polarization interesting is that it's not like the pluralism of the 1950s, where people who were allies on some issues were on opposite sides of others. Now it's pretty much us versus them politics, and it's on issue after issue, it's the same us on one side and the same them on the other. So, you know, you have sort of a unidimensionality of a political conflict, and that concentrates conflict, and it makes it much more likely to be heated.
Do you see this as a dark moment when it comes to our politics and our ability to govern ourselves if we are so polarized?
Polarization has its upsides and its downsides, I think, as most things do. For one thing, polarization brings a lot of issues to the forefront to be discussed. The old pluralistic politics, a lot of issues were submerged, never brought up because they would divide parties and so forth. And so I think that's healthy in the long run to have the issues out there. Also, we know voters are not, especially well-informed. In most cases, polarization ought to make voting for a party and a candidate who represents your views somewhat easier for the less informed voters, because we have other complications in this year's elections beyond polarization that may make that troublesome. But so there's that positive side. The negative side is that it does make compromise much more difficult. It makes the job of governing far more difficult than it had been. And at the end of the day, fewer people are satisfied with government. So, when we look at those right track, wrong track figures now, for instance, we see about 70% of Americans think the country's on the wrong track. Well, that includes both liberals and conservatives. The liberals think the country's not being governed enough to the left, and conservatives think it's not being governed enough to the right. And they don't understand that in a diverse and polarized nation, you're not going to get everything you want all the time, so you have to settle.
Doesn't it also encourage a deep cynicism in our government and in our way of organizing ourselves politically in the public sphere, and perhaps encouraging a sense of why bother apathy with participating in the process? We have such low voter turnout. Is this part of the problem?
Well, I think that the opposite's the case, that polarization increases the fact now that we have a polarized public and the parties are more polarized heightens representation and heightens the stakes that both sides see in the process. So, you know, if you had everybody in the middle, then, people don't care so much. If it goes a little to the left, that's not too far away from me. If it goes a little to the right, it's not too far away from me. But if you have a lot of people staked out in the left and the right, they see much more at stake in the elections. And turnout actually in general has gone up since polarization's increased.
The idea of red states and blue states is a fairly new idea. How did that come about?
Well, there have always been states that are more democratic. You know, actually, a key component to why the polarization of the parties took so long is that the Democrats had the solid South. That was, we didn't call it red or blue back then, but that was a solid Democratic territory. The Northeast was solidly Republican. It's hard to believe now, but that was the case back in the 40s and 50s. And so, you had that those divisions back then. They weren't quite as rancorous as they are now because you had again this mix within the parties. Within the Republican Party, you had the Jacob Javits, Nelson Rockefeller wing, and alongside the Barry Goldwater and Ronald Reagan wing. And so they were, they shared the common party label, and it meant something, or at least it meant some loyalty and the willingness to work within the party together. And the Democrats had the conservative segregationist Dixiecrats in the party alongside, Hubert Humphrey and George McGovern and pro-civil rights liberals in the North. So you had that mix within the parties that kind of muted this red state, blue state difference. Now they're homogeneous. Very few conservatives in the Democratic Party, very few liberals in the Republican Party. At this point, you wonder how there are any.
Yeah.
We're likely to see even greater polarization in the future as that gets further sorted out, as these kind of stragglers find their more natural homes.
Well, interestingly, as we become more polarized, the rise of the independent parties or people who say that they are independent politically, that has increased.
Well, we see some activity on that score. But if you're on the left, you don't want to end up supporting another kind of Ralph Nader spoiler. I mean, you would be so concerned about a conservative getting elected, you'll fall into line. There's strong pressures to fall into line with the Democrats. And the same is true on the Republican side. So polarization increases the stakes.
So either we need to change our system to a parliamentary system, or we would need a big cataclysmic event like a World War II to bring us all together?
Well, if we go to a parliamentary system, I think that just pushes back where the compromises are made. That just you still have this, and people may feel that they're electing somebody that they like, but at the end of the day, you have to form a coalition. You either do the formation of the coalition before the election, which I think makes more sense and is more sort of upfront with voters, or after the election, as they do in a parliamentary system. I think the key to settling things down, sort of ratcheting down the level of discord in the country, is for the parties to deal with the issues that are of greatest concern to everybody, and that's peace and prosperity.
Well, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That's James Campbell. He's a political science professor at the University of Buffalo and author of a new book. It's called Polarized: Making Sense of a Divided America. Well, speaking of polarized, some Bernie Sanders supporters who still can't get with Hillary are supporting Jill Stein, Dr. Jill Stein. She's running as the Green Party candidate. We'll talk to her about whether she's worried about playing the Ralph Nader role in this election. That's next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW. Find all of KCRW's music, storytelling, cultural, and news podcasts on our iTunes page.
You're listening to Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. For Bernie supporters who do not thrill to Hillary Clinton, there is another woman in the race, Dr. Jill Stein. She's the leading Green Party presidential candidate, and she hopes to attract people like Carol Krzyzewskis, a Sanders delegate from Nevada.
All my life I've been a Democrat, but a Democrat by default. They've always been too conservative for me, and since I was 18 till now when I'm 54, I've seen them moving so far to the right that at this point when a lot of people say, but you have to vote blue, you have to vote Democrat, you're a Democrat, I say to them, I have never voted for a Republican for president, and I'm not about to start now by voting for Hillary Clinton.
All right, well, Dr. Jill Stein joins us now. Welcome.
It's great to be here.
Great to have you. Well, Bernie Sanders says he plans to vote and campaign for Hillary Clinton aggressively, even though he disagrees with her on some issues. I want to play a clip of tape of him speaking to his supporters just before the convention.
We cannot have a president who insults Mexicans and Latinos, Muslims, women, and African Americans. We cannot have a president who, in the midst of so much income and wealth inequality, wants to give hundreds of billions of dollars in tax breaks to the very, very rich. We cannot have a president who, despite all of the scientific evidence, believes that climate change is a hoax. The major political task that together we face in the next 5 months is to make certain that Donald Trump is defeated and defeated badly.
All right, so let's begin with a question that is on everyone's mind. Are you concerned about being a spoiler? Everything points to a close election between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. Are you concerned that you would end up tilting it to Donald Trump?
So, you know, that question sort of implies that there's a new entitlement for big politicians. They're entitled to our votes, but actually, Hillary doesn't have our votes, and Donald doesn't have our votes. In fact, they are the most disliked and untrusted candidates throughout history. And in fact, the American public is clamoring for something else. So I think it's really a good idea that people not be intimidated into voting for their fears instead of voting for what they want. My campaign is the only campaign out there that is not poisoned by corporate money, by lobbyists, and by super PACs. So I have the unique ability to actually stand up for what it is that everyday people want, much like Senator Sanders was doing. But unfortunately, he was trying to move a political revolution inside of a counter-revolutionary party. So the party destroyed him. You know, he who would have been the strongest opponent to Donald Trump was beating him in every possible poll, and the issues stand up and are roundly supported by the American public. We have known throughout history that, in fact, the way to defeat right-wing extremism is through truly radical progressive policies. And unfortunately, Hillary Clinton has been the proponent of the policies that have created the economic misery that drives right-wing extremism, specifically NAFTA, sending our jobs overseas, and now being sort of a closet proponent of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which even her good friend Terry McAuliffe says she will be back on as soon as she's elected, and also Wall Street deregulation, which crashed 9 million jobs, allowed 5 million homes to be stolen out from under homeowners. So electing another neoliberal, putting another Clinton in the White House who helped create these policies underlying the surge of economic misery. The problem is not just Donald Trump. There are lots of politicians out there who are, advocates of horrific policies. And bear in mind that while Donald Trump says awful things about barring the gates to Muslim immigrants, for example, remember that under the Democrats, we've had a policy of deportation, of detention and night raids, deporting, actually doing it, deporting mm-hmm. millions of immigrants, including the immigrants from Honduras, women and children that have been fleeing the violence caused by the militarism represented by Hillary Clinton. So okay. This is exactly the wrong thing to do if we are truly going to defeat extremism.
Okay, so let's talk about what you want. Real Clear Politics polling average has you around 2.6% support. So in all likelihood, in the next 3 months, you probably will not win the presidential election. So what is your goal? What do you want right now? And again, are you afraid that you will take enough votes away and elect by default Donald Trump as the next president?
So let's be clear about the polling, because we were invisible in the polling 3 months ago. About 2 months ago, we were up to 2%. Now polls are showing us at 5%, 6%, and even 7%. So we've essentially tripled our numbers and more, even without a stitch of coverage by big corporate media. We've only begun to get a few minutes here and there from the larger cable stations. So this is by word of mouth. Our numbers have actually tripled, because we will actually cancel student debt. I'm the only
Do you think you could actually win in November?
Well, let's be clear. There are 42 million young people now, young people and not so young, who are trapped by predatory student loan debt brought to us by Democrats as well as Republicans, who do not have a future. And they are getting the word out themselves. If they have tripled our numbers in the last 6 weeks, can they double them again and get us into the polls? Then all bets would be off, because my campaign is actually able to provide, because we are not bought and sold by Wall Street and the war profiteers, which are funding Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump and the fossil fuel giants. I have the unique ability to stand up for a massive jobs program. We're calling for a new deal, a Green New Deal, which will solve the emergency of our economy as well as the emergency of climate. We will cancel student debt and make higher education free, and create a foreign policy based on international law and human rights, not on military domination, which has cost us $6 trillion, that's $75,000 per American household, for what Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump want to do more of.
But can you just answer my question about whether or not you worry, or your supporters worry, that you could tip the election to Donald Trump? I mean, I think what you're talking about is trying to get the 15% threshold of polling to get into the debates.
There are 42 million people, okay, who are trapped in debt. This is a very powerful incentive to come out and vote green. It's the only way for young people to get out of debt. 42 million is a plurality in a three-way race. So we don't have to split the vote. We could actually flip the vote and allow the underdogs, who are the American public, and especially the younger generation being thrown under the bus now, we could allow the underdog to actually become the top dog and actually have an economy and a future that works for all of us. So I think the question, you know, people love to throw at an inconvenient truth like myself, which is, you know, a woman in the race who doesn't just have the gender identity of a woman, but actually the policies, not for Wall Street, like Hillary Clinton has benefited throughout her career, not to push down living wages, as Hillary Clinton did in Haiti, where she actually led the charge to depress the pay of the hourly wage from 60 cents an hour, a miserable poverty wage. She led the charge to actually press it downwards, and aid to families with dependent children, the welfare social safety net. Hillary and Bill Clinton led the charge to end that social safety net and replace it with a very lousy system that has put another millions of children into poverty. So it's important to talk the substance of the issues, because we have the opportunity to get beyond our fears. Democracy needs a moral compass.
Okay, let's talk about the issues. You tweeted yourself that you took an eye side with Quiz Online and agreed with Bernie Sanders 99% of the time on the issues, and Hillary Clinton 91% of the time on the issues. So she has proposed a living minimum wage, a $12 minimum wage, and she supports a $15 minimum wage. She supports universal preschool. She's talked about overturning Citizens United. She talked about she has a lot of proposals on her website. And
talk
so
is the operative word here, you know, fool me once, shame on you.
But how do you differ from her? How do you differ from her substantially?
And let's bear in mind, you know, this is a quiz where candidates get to state their policy. And thanks to the pressure of the Sanders campaign, Hillary was forced to adopt more progressive positions. But let's not forget the walk and be distracted by the talk by a candidate. Remember, Bill and Hillary have amassed a fortune, $153 million since 2001 or so, just from these massive big corporations corporations providing the private speeches to the healthcare industry. So Hillary helped destroy the public option and the opportunity for true healthcare as a human right through a Medicare for All system, which would actually be working, unlike the Affordable Care Act, which is not affordable and not particularly caring when one in three Americans cannot afford healthcare. Hillary Clinton has done the bidding of the banks. She actually created the crime bill that opened the floodgates to mass incarceration.
Wait, she was first lady at that time. How did she create it?
Well, she takes credit for the policies that she helped advocate for and that she celebrated. So, for example, she takes credit for the Children's Health Insurance Plan, which she didn't actually create herself, but she advocated it for. So she advocated for deregulating Wall Street. And even now, she won't support true Wall Street regulation in order to get a handle on it. And that's no surprise because she is being funded by Wall Street. She won't release her Wall Street speeches that she, you know, arrangements she made behind closed doors. And look at the VP she appointed. What did they do to Bernie Sanders and the progressive agenda? If you ever had any doubts about what Hillary Clinton's intentions are, look at the VP she appointed, who is also a proponent of the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
Well, now he's against it.
Right. Hillary will be for it, as Terry McAuliffe said that she would. A good friend of hers and colleague said, don't worry about that. Once she's elected, she'll be back on board. And this is what Hillary does, which is why the American public has rejected her. And I would say to the professional pundits and the party operatives who are saying to the American people, who are screaming in pain, who are clamoring for a different kind of politics that's of, by, and for the people, you know, I would say the pundits should not be telling us to be good little boys and girls and go back into this dark night, because the American people have really had it with a political system that has rigged it, and we see how much it was rigged by these emails that were disclosed showing the DNC collaborating with Hillary's campaign, actually with the White House as well, and with big corporate media in order to grease the skids for Hillary and to shut down Bernie. And they relegated him.
We're running out of time here. I'm sorry to cut you off. We're running out of time here, and I just wanted to get to one question that we got a lot of questions. We asked our Twitter followers and Facebook followers what questions we should ask you. A lot of questions on your policy on vaccines. You're a doctor. Could you please clarify whether or not you are pro or against vaccines, mandatory vaccines?
I am pro good medications, and I am pro regulators that we can trust. So there's no doubt vaccines have made a huge contribution. They're a fundamental of good public health policy. And what I have said, you know, I don't watchdog vaccines myself. When I was a practicing clinical physician, I watchdogged every medication that I was prescribing and paid attention to the literature. And at that time, there were real questions raised about the vaccine schedule, about the mercury content in vaccines. I hope all that has been rectified. I haven't actually been watchdogging it myself. I believe it has been rectified. But, you know, everyday people and even doctors out there shouldn't have to devote their careers to watchdogging one substance.
They must watchdog by lots of scientific studies, by the CDC.
And that's why we need the CDC and the DEA to be free of the influence of the pharmaceutical companies and the device manufacturers and, you know, Monsanto, for that matter. They should not be in the business of, you know, controlling our regulatory agencies or influencing them. That's the only point.
You're saying the CDC is controlled by these corporations?
I said, or influencing them. Okay. I think when we have a Monsanto lobbyist heading the DEA, it creates public concern. It creates public doubt. And for those who would try to smear this as being anti-vax, I think they have a problem with the influence of money in politics. We need to stop that revolving door. I think this is a no-brainer. Okay. I think it's outrageous that people have tried to silence our call for institutions and regulators we can trust, because right now, the American public, you know how much they trust Congress? 4% of the American public has strong trust in Congress, and it's about 15% that has trust in the executive. So we need to get get the money out of politics.
Unfortunately, we are out of time. I'm really sorry to cut you off. I enjoyed speaking with you. Thank you very much. That's Dr. Jill Stein, presumptive Green Party nominee for president. And we'd love to hear from you. Do you plan to vote for Dr. Stein? Are you concerned she may help tip the election to Donald Trump? You can call us at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY or tweet us at KCRW-PRESS-PLAY. Coming up, new releases at the movies, including the new Bourne movie.
This is shaping up to be the year of the sequel nobody asked for.
We have other reviews as well. It's all ahead next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Listen to the Rhythm Planet podcast to explore music from all corners of the globe. Brazilian, European, African, and tropical Latin. Rhythm Planet is a state of mind. Listen at kcrw.com/rhythmplanet or on KCRW's app.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. This week's movie segment, all about thrillers and documentaries and a comedy about parenthood, so a little bit for everyone. Joining me to talk about them are Alonzo Duralde, chief film critic for The Wrap.
Hello.
Hi. And Dave White, film critic for LinoleumKnife.com.
Howdy.
Howdy. Great to have you guys back.
Thanks for having us.
By the way. All right, let's kick off today with Jason Bourne, the fifth installment of the franchise.
We've just been hacked. Could be worse than Snowden.
Facial recognition got a hit.
Jesus Christ, that's Jason Bourne.
Why would he come back now?
Why indeed?
Good question.
Why is he coming back now? And also, it's Matt Damon, not Jeremy Renner.
Right, yeah. That apparently was a sort of side thing that didn't go anywhere, so they decided to go back to basics. They brought back Matt Damon. They brought back director Paul Greengrass. This is shaping up to be the year of the sequel nobody asked for. And I did not think that Jason Bourne was going to go on that list, but it's the sequel nobody asked for, and they don't bring anything new to the table. It's not even greatest hits. It almost feels like outtakes that weren't interesting enough to be in the previous movies all sort of shoved together. So, you know, it's that Paul Greengrass edit style, you know, that he has mastered, but that has been so copied since he mastered it that it now just sort of feels kind
now
of
it feels
rote.
Like a cliche.
Yeah, and you know, it's basically it's people staring at screens. It's people going, "Oh my God, it's Jason Bourne!" And there's that pause where everyone pees themselves a little, and then there's like running through the streets and shooting, and the end you can barely make out what's going on.
Well,
visually,
what's the threat? What's the existential threat?
So this time,
Edward Snowden.
Well, Julia Stiles steals a bunch hacks the CIA, gets a bunch of files out, including Bourne's, gives him information he didn't know about his past. He now must find the people who did the thing and get, you know.
Yeah.
It's a
stuff
snooze.
We can't, stuff
this
we
movie.
Can't give away.
Yeah, that's I'm not going to spoil it.
Don't spoil it, because people will go see it.
Sure, yeah. No, I'm sure they will. But I was so bored.
I am really disappointed here, because I also loved the first three Bourne films. And
two of which were directed by Greengrass.
In the years that they were made, they were among my favorite movies of the year. I love a really competently executed action movie, one that has, you know, a purpose and a style. And Greengrass is so good at this. And it feels like in this installment that he knows he's good at it and is just...
So what is it lacking?
Back a
little
bit.
Does it need besides maybe a new visual style?
We had a story with the original films, and that story came to an end. I found myself counting the minutes until the last big car chase. Now,
in Vegas,
when the last big car chase happens, suddenly you feel like you're watching a movie that you would want to go see in the middle of a summer, even though it's visually kind of illegible.
Yeah, it's a chop. I had a hard time figuring out who was where and why and how, like, why cars were suddenly flipping over because another car drove by them.
Cars are flipping over, and okay, that is all that matters in that moment. And unfortunately, that's like the last 15 minutes
but,
of the movie.
So save your money and go see and go rent The French Connection.
I just wish, I have high expectations for this guy and these films, and I'm not angry. I'm just disappointed.
In the same way that Spectre was kind of an 007, this is an Bourne.
Okay, so boring Bourne. Let's move on to Bad Moms. The comedy stars Mila Kunis and Kristen Bell.
We're killing ourselves trying to be perfect, and it's making us insane.
In this day and age, it's impossible to be a good mom.
Screw it. Let's be bad moms.
Oh, I'm in.
Right?
Oh my gosh. Okay, this is exciting. I'm in.
Yes, to bad moms.
Bad moms.
Woo! Woo! How bad do they get?
Real bad, they Madeline get... Brand.
They get crazy, those bad moms.
What are they doing?
Well, in that scene, they're getting real tipsy, if you know what I mean. And then after that, they go on a spree through a supermarket, which is, I think, one of the great grocery store scenes in a movie since The Stepford Wives. I don't want to give away too much. This was a genuinely surprising and really funny movie. I was not expecting much. You know, we've had Bad Santa and Bad Teacher and Bad Grandpa, and it was kind of like, all right, fine, Bad Moms, whatever. The trailer wasn't great. And this movie is just shockingly hilarious. I mean, it starts a little slow. It feels a little Irma Bombeck at first, like, oh, the dog's got vertigo, that sort of wacky parental mishap.
Not Irma Bombeck. Don't soil her beautiful legacy. Here's what this first 15 minutes is. It's dire, first of all, because you're having all of your worst suspicions confirmed that it's going to be like that Sarah Jessica Parker movie. I don't know how she does it.
Right.
Yeah. Which also, you know, has nothing to do with Irma, the awesome Irma Bombeck.
Okay, sorry. I didn't mean to disparage Irma Bombeck. Nonetheless, after the Mila Kunis character hits her last nerve and she's kicked out her husband, she's, you know, she's not getting along with her boss at work. She's fed up with the monstrous PTA president played by Christina Applegate. When she just decides to stop trying to live up to the perfect mom image and go a little nuts, it's hysterically funny.
And what happens to the kids?
There's usually some reference to a sitter or they're staying somewhere. These aren't like super negligent moms. They're just a little bad, you know. It's directed by the guys who wrote all the Hangover movies.
Uh-huh.
So you get your party scene of like the people, you know, riding bikes off the steps of houses and doing crazy like slow-mo, you know, shotgunning of beers and dancing, whatever. But it's all middle-aged women and it's hysterical.
Well, this seems to be a theme too in recent movies. Women gone bad.
Yeah,
I suppose so. But the thing is, the movie isn't saying, "Oh, they're terrible." It's actually for a movie,
but
written,
acting like dudes.
But for a movie written by men, it feels really compassionate about women in terms of saying it's not that these moms are bad; it's that they are that nobody can live up to their own idea of what a mother is supposed to be and how much they're supposed to be there for their kids and for, you know, the school and for their job and for their husband. And so there's something, it's very liberating the way they kind of toss those shackles off. But at the same time, it's never not funny. You know, usually movies about somebody, you know, liberating themselves from oppressive society, that's a comedy killer, but not here.
I have to say, when Chelsea Clinton last night said that her mom left her a note for every day that she was gone.
Yeah.
The first thing I said when I turned to my friend, I said, I'm a bad mom. I've never done that.
Failure.
Well, I mean, honestly, this film falls short quite a bit as well.
It is flawed.
Flimsily plotted. Mm-hmm. There's nothing about this movie that has anything interesting or new or insightful to say about motherhood. But the meat of it, the comedy of it, is as if the wedding shop scene from Bridesmaids was a whole film. It's the craziest stuff.
It's not that scatological, but it is that just sort of wonderfully unhinged.
All right, let's move on to another thriller. This one's called Nerve. It's about a couple of young people who get sucked into a dangerous game.
All of our money is missing.
Wait, Mom, what? Officer! Officer, I need help.
Lee, don't do this.
How do you know my name? What the hell is going on?
Watchers, they stole our identities. We became prisoners of the game.
V, we control your life.
The only way out is to win.
Okay, so what's the premise here, Dave?
It stars Emma Roberts and Dave Franco.
Not James Franco.
Dave. Not, no.
The better brother?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know that I've ever been asked to choose a Franco. Yeah,
I don't want to choose a Hemsworth, and I'm not going to choose a Franco either.
Okay, good. We'll just leave it there.
So Emma Roberts plays a geeky teenage girl who's a photographer, and her friends and her family, they all say all the time, you sit on the sidelines and you just observe and you don't participate and you don't take risks. And she thinks, well, I'm going to show you. She starts playing a secret, what do they call it? Dark web.
Yes.
Game. Called Nerve, where you have to choose to be a watcher or a player, and it's a truth or dare game, but it's all dares, and they are increasingly dangerous, illegal, life-threatening dares. And when you finish a dare, you get money, and they just automatically deposit the money into your bank account. She wants to go to college, Cal Arts, as a matter of fact.
Oh. She wants to go to Staten Island, but she wants to go cross country.
Good choice.
And so she joins in the game, and she meets Dave Franco, who's already a player in the game, and they start playing together, and the dares get crazier and crazier. I won't spoil how it ends, but I had such a good time watching this movie. It is the dumbest 1986 teen movie about 2016 teens and their phones and the internet is bad, and it comes complete with its own corny message.
Which is what? Down the phone?
Yes.
And
stop hiding behind your screen.
See people put their phones down.
Yeah. Really?
It is so much fun and so silly and has a visual style that is very, very new and will date in about 10 minutes.
Yeah, like you've never seen this much neon in New York City in your life. You'd think it was Vegas. There's even neon under Dave Franco's motorcycle, so that when there's like a helicopter shot of them crossing the Brooklyn Bridge or whatever, you can spot his
Because wait,
hog,
they look like,
you know,
a video game. Is that the
kind
idea?
Kind of, yeah. I would say this movie is fun until it isn't. Okay. Like there's a kind of breezy ridiculousness to it, and then at some point it decides to stop and scold you about, you know, the internet.
See, I found even the scolding moments to be utterly hilarious and entertaining.
And it also, once you start asking any questions about wait, how is this put together and who's behind this game and what are they, it all kind of falls apart. But there is, for a good chunk of it, it is kind of breezy and stupid and fun.
All right, lightning round, two documentaries. One is about Robert Frank, the famous photographer. It's called Don't Blank Robert Frank. And Dave, you saw that one?
Yes, and it opens today at Lemley's Monica, and it's from Laura Israel, documentary filmmaker. It is about the decades-long career of Robert Frank. Now, if you don't know who he was, he's 91, still alive, still with us. He is the man behind The Americans, a late 50s photography book that is maybe the most influential collection of American photographs. He toured the country taking photographs of folks, and it got bad reviews at the time because he was taking pictures that directly conflicted with the idea of the 50s and its optimism. Mm. And he was accused of hating America for taking these photographs, which is a funny, relevant sort of criticism that is still happening right now. It goes through his entire life. He directed films. He directed Pull My Daisy with the Beats, Jack Kerouac and Allen Ginsberg. He directed the Rolling Stones documentary with a title that I cannot say on the radio that was famously never released, Something Blues. And you can now only see it in museums if Robert Frank is there. That's the legal.
Oh, well, so maybe not much longer.
Yeah. He's a fascinating man. It's short. It's not enough. You need a 10-part miniseries for this guy's life. He's lived a lot.
Right.
But it's a wonderful snapshot of him.
Okay. And another one about another artist. This one's called Women He's Undressed, and it's about the costume designer, old Hollywood costume designer, Ori Kelly.
Yes, who I think is a somewhat forgotten figure, but a really important one. He was Warner Brothers' in-house designer for a long time, especially in the 30s and 40s. So pretty much like all of the Bette Davis movies of the early great part of her career, he designed her outfits, including the famous Jezebel dress. He designed the clothes that Ingrid Bergman wore in Casablanca and that Rosalind Russell wore in Auntie Mame. And not only Marilyn Monroe's dresses for Some Like It Hot, but also Tony Curtis's and Jack Lemmon's. And
very fetching.
Yes. And he was Australian, and the film is directed by Gillian Armstrong, who's one of my favorite directors anywhere on the planet. She did My Brilliant Career and the 1994 remake of Little Women. And so she's kind of celebrating this Aussie who made it big in Hollywood. And because Ori Kelly is long dead, there's an actor kind of playing him. And the guy playing Ori Kelly talks about the passionate love affair that he had in his youth with one Archibald Leach before he went to Hollywood and became Cary Grant. Exactly. And then there's also interviews with costume designers like Anne Roth and experts like Deborah Nadelman Landis, and then actresses that worked with him like Jane Fonda and Angela Lansbury, and tons of clips. So if you like vintage Hollywood and fashion and gossip, like, this movie is it's a big box of chocolates.
Who doesn't like that?
Exactly. It's opening at the Arena Cinema Hollywood today, and I believe it's hitting DVD in the next couple weeks from Wolf.
Okay, so it sounds like documentaries this week over the feature films.
Bad Moms, pretty funny.
Bad Moms is really funny.
Okay. All right, you bad boys. Thank you very much.
Thanks,
Madam. Alonzo Duraldi, chief film critic for The Wrap. Dave White, film critic for linoleum-knife.com. Coming up, how pot made it to the county fair and how you judge it. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Listen to KCRW's music stream, Eclectic 24, for hand-picked music around the clock. You can find all of KCRW's produced content on our app. Download for free at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The stakes are high this summer at the Oregon State Fair, particularly in the brand new category of best marijuana plant. Across the aisle from the guy hawking ShamWows, the state's finest examples of farm-grown weed will be on display. And here to tell us more is Donald Morse, director of the Oregon Cannabis Business Council. Hi.
Hi. Thank you.
And we're also joined by Jake Brown. He is the cannabis critic for the Denver Post. Hi, Jake.
Hey, thanks for having me, Madeline.
Great to have you. Well, Don, let's begin with you. The Oregon Cannabis Business Council is behind the push to have these plants at the fair. How do you judge a marijuana plant?
Well, you judge it on qualities like spatial noting, leaf structure, shape, form, you know, whether or not it closely resembles the perfect specimen for the particular strain of cannabis that it is. All these plants are being judged in a non-flowering state, so we expect them to be between 2 and 4 foot tall.
So not smoking it?
No, not at all. We are celebrating the plant as an agricultural commodity. The state of Oregon this year said that cannabis is a farm crop. And it's time that it be treated as such and be given its day at the state fair.
Okay, a farm crop that has a specific purpose. Jake, can you judge a plant without sampling it?
I mean, you know, I respect what Don's trying to do, but if Top Chef judged the contestants based on who grabbed the best ingredients from the pantry, that, you know, without a finished flower, there just isn't much to judge, and we grow cannabis because of the flower.
Right. So how would you do the judging?
I mean, honestly, you need finished flower. In a competition like this, it all starts with genetics. It doesn't matter if you're Rembrandt, if you're starting off with a box of crayons, Madeline. So, you know, have some great genetics, grow them out to flower, and that's where a lot of the real ability comes through.
Don, you know, you don't judge, a blueberry without tasting it, right?
Right.
It might look good, but if it tastes sour, it's a bad blueberry. So...
Well, unfortunately, at this juncture... you have to take baby steps. We're only allowed, because of state laws, to exhibit non-flowering plants.
Huh.
So you have to also look at the purpose of what we're trying to do. The Oregon Cannabis Business Council, this is our second year taking a booth at the state fair. Last year, all we had were videos on TVs and flyers that we handed out, telling people about the growing process and extracting process and how edibles were made, etc. It was our goal to graduate this year to non-flowering, non-psychoactive plants, because there are many people in this state, as I'm sure there are across the country, who have never seen a cannabis plant. And we're looking to destigmatize the industry and cannabis. And I think the best way to do that is to get people up and close and asking questions. And so that's our goal. It's not quite so much as, finding the perfect producing cannabis plant.
So you want there to be more production of cannabis plants. That's the ultimate goal.
Well, Oregon is legalized, and there are a lot of farmers out there, and they're all proud of what they do. And just as they're proud with the end product, they're also proud of the plants as a as part of the agricultural community now. And that's what we're highlighting.
Okay. And Jake, you actually sample weed for a living?
Yeah, that's my job, believe it or not.
Wow. Okay. So how do you do that when this is such an individualized reaction and people react to weed in very different ways?
I think that criticism's always subjective, in the same way that two people can have differing opinions on what makes a great Pinot Noir, but, you know, that doesn't stop Wine Spectator from slapping a number on the bottle. At the end of the day, there are characteristics that great marijuana should always express, and the way that people react to it tends to be very similar.
What are those characteristics?
So you're looking for a great cure smell and taste that is, characteristic of those particular genetics. And then, there are different types of marijuana that can make you feel energetic or too energetic, paranoid, sleepy, hungry. That's the great part of this plant, is that there isn't one experience. There's a multitude.
Have you ever sampled, for work and thought, oh, my gosh, I can't. I'm in way over my head. I'm too high to even write a sentence.
Only with edibles.
Right. And so, Don, do you have edibles on display as well?
I mean, no,
just display.
There is no cannabis allowed other than these plants, at least for this year. Like I said, we're approaching this in baby steps. It's my hope that, within a year or two, we would be able to display award-winning edibles, not just for their flavor and creativity, but for their effect and whatnot. Same thing with concentrates and flowering plants.
Would you hand out samples at a future fair?
Well, law does not allow that.
If it were possible, would you want
to? If it were possible, I don't see why not.
Okay, different county fair.
And I would say be very careful. At the Denver County Fair in 2014, there was an edibles company that was supposed to make non-medicated samples. At the end of the day, over 100 people were accidentally given marijuana and ended up very uncomfortable.
Yipes. Okay. Well, thanks for that warning. Jake Brown, cannabis critic for the Denver Post. Donald Morse, director of the Oregon Cannabis Business Council. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Madeline.
Thanks for having us.
All right. And that'll do it for us here at Press Play. I'm going on vacation, so you will be in the able hands of Steve Teotakis next week. Have a great weekend, everyone. I'm Madeline Brand.
Support for Press Play comes from the Kane Foundation. Rick and Suzanne Kane and Jenny, Maggie, and Sari Kane. The Kane Foundation is committed to enriching the cultural and civic life of Los Angeles. For over a decade, the Kane Foundation has made strategic grants to make Los Angeles a better place to live for future generations.